Welcome to From the Booth, the podcast sponsored by BYU International Cinema. I'm Chip Oskerson, co-director of International Cinema, coming to you from Paris, France, joined today by IC Assistant Director Marie-Laure Oskerson. Welcome, Marie-Laure.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Today, Marie-Laure and I will be discussing with some special guests the IC films that showed from the 30th of October to the 2nd of November 2019. These films are all from our Halloween week and include The Farewell, Meeting Gorbachev. After we discuss those, we'll be talking with fellow IC co-director Mark Yamada about A Tale of Two Sisters, and then finally a conversation I had with Professor Doug Weatherford from Spanish and Portuguese on Macario. In our discussion of these films, we'll presume that you've seen them, so we won't be giving any spoiler alerts, but later on in this episode, when we get to previewing the films for this coming week, we'll suggest some key things to look for, but without giving away anything important to the unfolding of the plot. We provide time codes in the program notes if you need to skip forward in our discussion. So, Marie-Laure, let's start this week with The Farewell. This was the audience favorite, I think, for the week. A film directed by Lulu Wang. This is her second film, and starring Awkwafina, which some of our audience might recognize. She's kind of a figure from popular culture, playing a different kind of character, right?
Then when we saw her in Crazy Rich Asians.
That's right.
A very light role for her, but here it's a main role, and she's amazing. More a somber context, but still playful.
Yeah. Well, this film is interesting because it really pits her as an American, as a Chinese American, over and against her relatives, right, who are all Chinese, but some of them are living in Japan, some of them are living in China. The basic plot, of course, is that her grandmother is dying. She's been diagnosed with a terminal illness, but nobody's told the grandmother about this. And for Billy, this isn't the way you do things.
And nobody is intending on telling her, and they go to extreme measures to hide the truth and to pretend. They gather the family for a fake wedding, and Billy does not want to have anything to do with this, and a lot of her Westerner personality is coming through, which is a threat to the family in crisis in this story.
Yeah, it's kind of a crisis of authenticity for her. She wants to be herself, and everyone else is left. I like the way that I read in the way the cinematographer talked about this, that the characters had to play themselves playing themselves, right? So that they're all there at the wedding playing a part, but none of the characters can be authentic. And this is the big problem, I think, for Billy, is that she really struggles with doing that and asking the question, why should we do this? Isn't it always better to tell the truth? But that's kind of what it really helps to get us to question, is are there times when it's not the best thing to tell the terminally ill person that they're terminally ill? Is the reason that we think it is the right thing to do because we have a very specific notion of what individuality is and what individual responsibility is?
Yes, actually the uncle says about this to Billy, you think your life belongs to yourself. In the East, a person's life is part of a whole. And this film really is great at showing this. You talked about this lie and the family dynamics around this lie and how much energy they put into it. Well, what was interesting as well is when we saw Billy for the first little while at the beginning of the film in America, she navigates lying, little white lies that we all say so well. Like, she's so comfortable and it's part of her personality and it's charming. It's so endearing. Like, we love her right away. And then when it's about life and death and about this really close grandma, she loves her so much. She's so close to her. It's part of who she is as well, this relationship with this grandma who lives in China. She can't lie. She has to have this authenticity about herself. It feels that Chinese family is criticizing.
Right.
But it really helped me see another side of family relationship. At first, I was sided. You know, of course Billy is right, and what are they doing lying to this poor grandma? But at the end of the film, I saw another side of family relationship, and it really helped me understand a Chinese traditional family. I'm not sure if I can say traditional, but it helped me understand a little bit more of the East, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and for me, it really got me to question, why do we make certain assumptions about a self, right? About the independence of a self. And I like that the uncle goes on to talk about how we as a family have the responsibility of bearing this burden for her. And that's interesting because it is a very different way to think. And in what way do we bear one another's burdens? I don't know. It always has to be by lying to each other necessarily, but it's thinking about it that way puts it certainly in a more positive light. It's interesting too that this is actually based on a true story, right? And the grandmother in question, who had this diagnosis now 6 years ago, is still alive and doing well. So maybe it's better that they didn't ruin the party to begin with by giving her bad news
and providing one of the best endings for this film.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The way that this is shot is there was real challenges. I think they were working in China. A lot of the action takes place in China. It's, you know, great the way we go back and forth between Mandarin and English in this film, but trying to film the entire family in these very tight spaces was a challenge for the cinematographer. And they wanted to use a kind of wide aspect ratio so that they could get as much of the family in the picture as possible, which I think is kind of interesting that you can definitely notice when you watch this film. Great characters. I thought it was serious humor, light, but with kind of a serious edge. I really thought it was a great film.
Absolutely. Moving and yet very playful. Yeah. About a topic that is very serious.
That's right. Well, the next film that we have to talk about is A Tale of Two Sisters. And for that, Mark Yamada and I had a conversation. And so here's the conversation I had with Mark. Thanks for helping out with this, Mark.
No problem.
Tell us a little bit about this film and what you saw as the big takeaway.
Yeah, A Tale of Two Sisters. This is Ji-won Kim's Korean horror film from 2003. Really influential work of Korean horror, and really a work that has influenced new Korean cinema of the early 2000s as well. It's a film that's based on a well-known tale in Korean culture about a stepmother and two sisters. And the film takes a kind of an interesting, fresh take on this story, mixing in a few twists that I don't think I'll reveal here because it'd be nice for listeners to watch it for themselves. But using in some ways maybe some of this M. Night Shyamalan style of twists and things in the storytelling, but mixing that with some of the conventions that I think have become staples in new Korean cinema in the early 2000s. And this is directors like Park and Bong that you'll see films from at...
Yeah, we've had several of their films at IC, haven't we?
Right. Some of these films that we've shown at IC. And there's something about these films that are, you know, very atmospheric. And I think it's not the same kind of horror experience that you might be expecting with horror, that it is a little bit more of a subtle experience. And I think something I really like about this film is that it has this Shakespearean, almost over-the-top story dealing with family and conflict, but it also has a really beautiful style of cinematography. There's this almost kind of, and this is something that you'll see in a lot of Korean cinema, this kind of tableau style of framing, bright color palette, something that you wouldn't expect from horror, right? That more of a high-key style, which is something that I think you'll see in a lot of Korean cinema, this kind of color palette that's used quite a bit. And it seems like, you know, this is something that you see in a lot of horror films or something that's, you know, a theme of a lot of horror. But, you know, this idea of trauma is something that you'll see in this film, but also, you know, really a theme in a lot of recent Korean cinema, maybe due to the fact that Korea has undergone, you know, some massive transformations in its social and political and economic areas. And, you know, there's a little bit of this kind of memory of the past. And in some ways, the violence and the activism that kind of resisted a lot of this development is still kind of fresh in people's minds. And so that's part of maybe what's going on here.
Is it significant that it takes place in a family context too?
Yeah. And it, you know, it's a family context. You get some of these.
It becomes uncanny when that happens, I guess.
That's right. And it all happens inside a house. And we're kind of seeing things from the perspective of one of the sisters who is kind of an unreliable narrator, which is, you know, interesting. Not really a narrator, but an unreliable perspective for us to kind of see things through.
Right.
And we kind of discover that the way that what we're seeing is not necessarily what is, you know, happening in reality, and that some of her mental illness and some of the past and the trauma she's experienced is coming back to kind of influence the way that she sees things. And so you have the stepmother, who's kind of a powerful figure, and you have the two sisters. And the father, like a lot of fathers in Korean cinema, are these retreating kind of weaker figures in the film, not really mm-hmm. kind of the strong patriarchs that you might expect. And it seems like to be a case with a lot of Korean film from this time, and even Japanese film in post-war, that it's really kind of these father figures that are kind of missing or weaker, or not really kind of central in the story. And that's kind of the case here. So it's very much a story of these two sisters and dealing with stepmothers and all the trauma and psychological
baggage of stepmothers.
Yeah, that comes with that. So it's, really, I think it's a good one to get into because it's really, this film was made right at the beginning of this new Korean cinema of the early 2000s. So it's really in some ways setting some of the conventions and the style that later directors and films would utilize.
That's great. Well, thanks for dropping in to give us a little bit of a take on this, A Tale of Two Sisters. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah.
The third film that we're going to talk about this week is Meeting Gorbachev. This is our documentary from the week. Meeting Gorbachev is made by Werner Herzog, who's a familiar character for many of our regular IC patrons. And this film is in German and Russian and Polish and English. It's all over the place. Marder, what struck you about this film? What kind of jumped out to you about it?
Well, two things. Meeting Gorbachev, I really met the man. I met
yeah, you get very, a sense for who he is, don't
absolutely,
you?
Yes. The warmth, the human, the man who feels has made a lot of mistakes as well in his political life. But a picture of someone that I would absolutely enjoy meeting and getting to know. So that was like the human element of the documentary that I really enjoyed. And the other one that amused me, I mean, of course, Herzog is a great filmmaker. He's very skillful. He knows what he does, and it's this documentary is beautifully done. But it could have been called as well Meeting Herzog as one of the
he's as much a character in it as Gorbachev.
Reviews I read just mentioned. So absolutely. So we always come back to Herzog and his understanding of things and his comments on things. So that was very interesting.
Yeah, Herzog
and I enjoyed
kind
that.
Of has to put himself in all of his films. I think he's such a a larger than life figure. And even some of the questions that he asks that kind of go nowhere, they're the kind of thing that you would think you would edit out in if it was another filmmaker. The one of the ways that I thought about that, I mean, on the one hand, I was a little bit irritated that he was kind of inserting himself in the film, but on the other hand, it did get me to think about one of the things that I think is going on in this film, which is that Herzog is expressing a kind of gratitude on the part of the German people. The end of the Cold War could have been so bloody. What happened in Germany could have, with the coming down of the wall, could have gone in so many different directions. In fact, it's even more likely that it would have been a hard crackdown on the people that were trying to leave. And there could have been a lot of bloodshed. The unification of Germany, the reunification of Germany might never have happened, or at least happened at a great higher price. But because of the intervention of Gorbachev, it didn't. And one of the things that comes out with Herzog being such an important figure in the film is that he's expressing that love, right? That appreciation and that love that the German people have for the role that Gorbachev played in this whole drama.
It's true that we can see Herzog's interventions and comments and questions as well as like a really caring filmmaker for Gorbachev and what he did for the world.
Yeah. Those of our IC patrons who were able to make it to the post-screening discussion with Astrid Tumenez, who's the current president of UVU, they were in for a real treat too, in that she shed some great light on the context of this film. She herself has interviewed Gorbachev four times, so one more time than Herzog did for the film, and she provided some important background and context to what's going on here. The film is, I think, a really great one to get us started for what's going to be coming next week, which is all about kind of celebrating the coming down of the wall. Well, the last film from this week is Macario, a film that was chosen specifically because of its tie-in with The Day of the Dead. And to talk about this, I had a conversation with Professor Doug Weatherford from Spanish and Portuguese. So here's that conversation. To discuss Macario, I'd like to welcome Professor Doug Weatherford from the Department of Spanish and Portuguese. He's been on the podcast before. He specializes in Mexican literature and film, and especially the work of the author Juan Rulfo, who was an author. He also wrote screenplays and was a photographer. So he is well-versed in film and media studies. Thanks for being with me, Doug.
You bet. Thanks for the invitation.
I found this to be a real interesting film. The way that we came to it as a selection committee at International Cinema was that we've had students for several years who have been pushing for it. And it seemed like a nice time to do it around Halloween and the Day of the Dead. And when I first saw it, I was a little bit put off by the copy that we were able to get because there aren't good copies of this film available. And we searched high and low. But they kept pushing, and I was really taken by the story. And I think even though the quality of the print wasn't great, it was still good enough that you could really see some of the interesting cinematography going on in this film. What's the place of this film generally within Golden Age Spanish cinema from, you know, the mid-20th century?
Yeah, well, the film actually is from 1960, so it actually falls outside of the time period that is typically called the Golden Age of Mexican cinema, which is from 1936 to 1956. And it's actually in a moment in which Mexican cinema that had risen to fairly high heights is in a bit of decline. And so the film is one of the first attempts by the Mexican film industry to kind of recapture some of its previous glory. And of course, the film was shown at the Cannes Film Festival and had just a remarkable cast and crew working on it. Roberto Gabaldon is the director, and there's kind of a love-hate relationship with Gabaldon in Mexico. He had a few really strong pictures, but especially after this time, a lot of his filmmaking kind of tends more towards what they call a churro, just like the food, right? The dessert, mm-hmm. Part because they're cheap, they're mass-produced, you know, the public there's not really a lot there, you know, type of thing. But the rest of the people working on the film are just really remarkable figures in Mexican industry, especially the editor Gloria Schumann, who has, you know, did hundreds of films in this time period. The set.
Interesting that it's a woman too. That was fairly common both there and Hollywood and other places, I think.
Yeah, and she just worked on everything, but was really talented and had to work under incredible time restraints. The set director, the artistic director, was a guy by the name of Manuel Fontanals, who just a tremendous artist in his own right. But clearly, I think the person that makes the film most interesting is the cinematographer, Gabriel Figueroa, who is the cinematographer from Mexico that has traditionally received the most acclaim. And although there are three directors of photography working transnationally, especially in Hollywood, that of Mexican origin who are kind of taking his place, Gabriel Figueroa is the inspiration, I think, for much of the success of Mexican of Mexican filmmaking in general, but especially cinematography in and outside of Mexico, in and outside of Hollywood. So he's just really a figure that if you want to know anything about Mexican film, you should know something about Gabriel Figueroa.
Well, I love the fact that you're drawing our attention to figures that are not the director, that are not the main actor or actress, right? That so often film studies has focused on those figures, and they, of course, are very important to the making and success of a film. But just as much so are these other kinds of figures that you're talking about, right? The editor of the film, you know, the script writer, the cinematographer, the, you know, set designer, all of these are contributing in such important ways. And I think that you could write a really interesting history of film by looking at these other kinds of roles, and you would get a very different picture that would emerge. Like you said, that you have one editor that's working on hundreds of movies, right? And that there might be an interesting story to kind of trace through and see in the way that you're pointing us to here.
Yeah, and I've always kind of liked to find some of those unique, perhaps hidden histories in film, especially in Mexican film. And I think it's a lot of fun, and especially to see some connections. In fact, I'm working on a project right now that will publish a couple of screenplays that were from movies, El Gallo de Oro, The Golden Cockerel, and Pedro Páramo from 1964 and 1966, respectively, that really didn't succeed as far as being quality film projects. But they have so many people working on them that for some reason, for one reason or another, the films are significant within the history of Latin American and Mexican film. In this particular case, both of these film scripts included the participation of two really important writers, one by the name of Carlos Fuentes and the other the Colombian Nobel Prize winner, Gabriel García Márquez. And so I think it is kind of fun to seek out those stories that perhaps always don't meet the popular imagination of the typical film-going public, but that are really important stories to tell.
Right, yeah, that they actually help explain a lot more in some ways. I refer to the listeners of the podcast really should listen to your lecture. You gave such wonderful background and context for this film. We're going to post that on the International Cinema website. You can see that alongside with the film page for Macario. I want to ask you just a couple questions about the film itself and the kind of the narrative of the self. Macario, I found to be a really interesting figure. As a character, he embodies both a kind of selfishness, but also a selflessness that's very real, I think, in a lot of ways. You know, we can assume that our listeners have seen the film, so you don't need to worry about giving away any plot points here. But that complexity really spoke to me, that he was both of these things. He wasn't entirely good, but he certainly wasn't evil either.
Right. Yeah. And I think one of the important things to see in this film is that it's very regional in the sense that Roberto Gabaldon is trying to give us, at least to a certain extent, an accurate portrayal of some of the customs of mm-hmm. the Day of the Dead, right? And so throughout the film, you'll see representations of ofrendas and burning candles and the calaveras, right. The skulls, you know, candy skulls that children eat at that time period. But the film really isn't just about Mexico or understanding Mexican history or sensibilities. It's a very universal film. And it really is perhaps more about archetypes, mm-hmm. good and evil. So you have the characters that appear to Macario, you know, after he's gone off with the turkey that his wife has stolen for him and that she has allowed him to consume all by himself. And so you've got, you know, the devil, you've got the Lord, and you've got death. And of course, Macario and his wife, I think, both are also kind of these mythic characters, perhaps representing, as you say, you know, selflessness, dedication, family, honor, but also perhaps a little bit at the same time that sense that that everybody wants something for themselves.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it makes them kind of more rounded and real. Even at the same time, I agree with you that there's something kind of archetypal going on. I mean, one of the things that I couldn't help thinking of, especially towards the end of the film, is the way that Macario begins to emerge, and his wife too, is these kinds of existential heroes, right? So that, you know, the kind of existentialism of the mid-20th century, where, you know, the only meaning we basically have is that we face death and we have to face it heroically and try and scrape out meaning on our own. I mean, there seem to be these strong overtones that, you know, death is going to win in the end. There's nothing that can be, you know, done to avoid that. But this kind of affirmation of life nonetheless, right? That we have, you know, that the wife says something at the end of, you know, that we've been able to live together, right? And have this moment together, and that there's meaning in that alone, right?
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think there are a lot of course, one of the interesting things about this film is that it's based on a screenplay written by B. Traven, you know, a German
mysterious author, right?
And it has a lot of the Brothers Grimm in it as well, right? So there's something beyond the Mexican, but there really is a very distinctly, I think, Mexican perspective on life and death and the dignity of facing the challenges, right? I mean, I think that we could easily fall into the romanticization of poverty, which you know, does happen in Mexican cinema, and that is sometimes criticized, and I think perhaps rightly so. But there is a distinct a reverence, I think, for individuals who find a way to cope in difficult circumstances. And if Macario is perhaps to be blamed for being a little bit selfish in wanting something of his own, we also realize that it's tempered by years and years of selfless dedication to his family in the face of distinct.
No, I think that's exactly right. One last question for you. Is it important that Macario is coded as indigenous?
It is.
I mean, is that even a good reading? That, I mean, is that what's going on, that there's something of the indigenous in him? And if so, why might that be important?
Yeah, well, I think you're absolutely right that the representation, or the attempt at the representation of Macario, is that he is an indigenous character. You can tell by some of the ways in which he lives, the clothes that he dresses in and whatnot. And of course, 1960 is fairly far removed from the post-revolution years of the 1920s and 1930s, but it's connected to that time period when, after the Mexican Revolution of 1910 to 1917, there was a real distinct search for the national identity. You know, who are we after this period of violence, and especially after the Porfirian dictatorship that preceded it? And one of the common ways that Mexican artists and intellectuals and filmmakers and writers began to identify the national was through its indigenous roots. And so in film, you can go back even to the Soviet director Sergei Eisenstein, who shoots a film in 1931 called Que Viva Mexico, the never finished film, but that looks at the indigenous roots as a representation of what is truly Mexican. And then you see that bleed through all kinds of different texts, including the muralists with Diego Rivera and Orozco Figueroa, for example, and all the way up into Mexican film. And so in a very real sense, I think that this film is still finding something to celebrate in the unique nature of Mexican identity through its indigenous roots. Now that comes with, you know, a important caution in the sense that one of the challenges of this perspective that I've just described is the tendency to idealize and to romanticize the indigenous, and in many ways to erase the indigenous, because instead of an actual indigenous actor, we're using, you know, a mestizo actor from the capital who will be fairly well off, you know, who dresses down as an indigenous character. So I tend to prefer to see the positive in most works of art. And I would agree with you that I think that this is an attempt to positively portray Mexico's indigenous heritage. But we need to be open to the possibility that there are some elements of baggage, perhaps, that can be connected to the film as well.
Right. Great. Well, thank you so much, Doug, for taking the time to be with us. Again, I highly recommend our listeners to check out your lecture, because I think it really gives some important context to this work. Thanks for being with us once again.
Thank you very much.
Well, now let's turn and preview the films coming for the week, the 6th to the 9th of November. There's a common theme running through all of these films, which has to do with walls, the idea of walls. Three of the films are specifically about East and West Germany and the wall that ran between them. And the last film, our documentary, is Midnight Traveler, which is about walls of a different kind. This is all to commemorate the coming down of the Berlin Wall in 1989. For those of our audience born after 1989, let's go through just a really quick history lesson. At the end of World War II, Germany was divided. Germany and Berlin both were divided into four sectors each. One was controlled by the Americans, one by the British, one by the French, and one by the Soviet Union. The advent of the Cold War, this division became a more hard, fast division. The British, French, and American sectors, of course, were united under West Germany and West Berlin, and the Eastern Germany was what was left of the area controlled by the Soviet Union. In 1961, there was a wall built around the western portion of Berlin, that portion, again, that was controlled by the American, British, and French. And the wall was built supposedly to protect the citizens of East Germany from the harmful influences of the West. And of course, the wall in West Berlin was legendary. It was a high concrete barrier with kind of a death zone in between, and it became a real symbol for the Iron Curtain and the wall between East and West. The wall came down rather suddenly and abruptly after a turbulent time, and encouraged, in fact, by Mikhail Gorbachev, as we heard from the film last week. The 9th of October 1989, the East German government formally declared that all citizens of East Germany, the GDR, could visit West Germany and West Berlin. And so that's what we're commemorating this week. So, Marilyn, the first film is a great family film, even, Balloon.
Absolutely. All children who can read subtitles should come.
That's right.
It's a political thriller, but commercially minded film, so very much approachable and easy to watch, even though we are on the edge of our seats.
That's right. It's a thriller.
There's a lot happening that keeps us guessing.
Remind us of the basic story, what it's telling about.
It's about two families and who are living in East Germany, and we see how much they suffer from the restrictive totalitarian regime, and they want to escape. And the idea that they have, and that it's based on a true story, building of the balloon, or hot air balloon to cross the border, is authentic. It's something that people did.
It's a rather audacious way to cross the border, really.
Very, very audacious. So this film is an exciting film. I would, if you want to be caught by it and just let yourself ride along. But if you want to see how the film builds attention, then just stop and pause and look what brings that tension and the thriller effect.
Yeah. The second film for the week is Wings of Desire by Wim Wenders from 1987, so 2 years before the unpredictable fall of the wall. This might be one of the greatest films from the 20th century. It's been at IC several times before. It will come back many times again. And when I teach my German-Scandinavian cinema class, this is regularly one of the favorite films. It's about a divided Berlin. The division of Berlin is used as kind of a metaphor, and the wall is this omnipresent thing. But Wim Wenders isn't making a political commentary so much as a philosophical one. The basic plot of the film is that there are angels in Berlin. In fact, the German title is Der Himmel über Berlin, so the heavens above Berlin, or the skies above Berlin. Angels are able to hear the thoughts and witness the actions of women and men, but they can only indirectly affect or influence the actions that are taking place in front of them. So their role is that of a witness. The angels, they see in black and white, and whereas people see in color.
Absolutely. And in their work of listening, it's very poetic. It describes the spiritual life of the angels. And at first, the film is very much like this poem, this graceful filming of the spiritual life. And it takes its time. And we just have to enter this world and understand that the plot is not going to be as driving as the wanderings of these two angels who are there to love and to help. People have a hard time hearing what they say, but we hear, and we hear what people think. And there again, as a viewer, this film really helped me love more. Like I got a beautiful message of love out of this film.
No, that's exactly right. And I think that's thinking about it as visual poetry is a good way to, you know, to enter it. The screenplay, speaking of philosophy and poetry, was co-written by Wim Wenders and Peter Handke. And of course, Peter Handke just this year won the Nobel Prize for Literature. So this is very timely that we're showing it this semester. That decision was made before we had found out about the Nobel Prize.
And for people who love Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast, know that Henri Alcan was the one who took care as well of the cinematography in this film, and it is a beauty. It is absolutely
kind of imitates angels, right? The way it floats through the city.
Absolutely. And you'll see as well, look for things about like the angels' lives and then the people's lives and what characterizes one or the other. And look what when the film is more about being and when the film is more about doing, look for themes like that.
Yeah, I think one additional thing I would say to look for is to think a little bit about what an angel can understand being outside of time and having this broad perspective of humanity and the history of nations that go by for them in a blink. as opposed to what we understand being in time. There's something the angels understand that we don't understand as mortals. There's something that mortals understand that angels don't get, that they desperately want, about what that experience of being in time is. And for me, yeah, I think that this is one of the big takeaways too. Well, the third film for the week is Goodbye Lenin. This too is about the coming down of the Berlin Wall. It's a comedy from 2003. And it's the basic premise is that a mother who's a diehard, devout communist falls ill and suffers, she goes to a coma. And during the time she's in a coma, the Berlin Wall comes down. There are all of these radical changes to the East that would have just horrified her. And lo and behold, she wakes up. And when she wakes up, her doctors tell her devoted son that by all means, she cannot have any shocks, because if she is shocked, she'll die. So he now has to go to great lengths to preserve the illusion that the wall never came down.
And that's interesting if we think back about the farewell and how a whole family gathered around a grandmother and nurtured this lie about her health. Here, it's children who are doing exactly the same thing, but creating a new reality for this mother. I guess an ongoing reality so that she's not shocked by the world of today. And so some of the things that I would look in this film is, first of all, messages like it's all based on fake news. You will love and laugh at the ingenuity of those children at recreating the world. So how is fake news used to recreating a lost reality? And as well, themes of deception, but not only deception of the other, but self-deception.
Right.
How far does someone go to kind of like recreate a Germany that maybe was not exactly like this, but could have been ideal for the people recreating it? So deception, self-deception, fake news, it's a treat.
Right. Well, and it's interesting because I think it uses comedy to probe to probe us a little bit, to say, okay, so we kind of take for granted that the West was better than what it overcame, but what was lost in the process, right? Kind of like you're saying that there's this nostalgia. In fact, it's referred to sometimes as nostalgie in German, this idea of this nostalgia for the East. Now, of course, it was a horribly repressive regime, and there was a lot not to be nostalgic for at all. But there were certain things that that it did bring with it, and especially in an era of political chaos and upheaval, there's this nostalgia sometimes for the good parts that have been lost. And I think that that's why this film was made in 2003 and why it continues to, to echo in some ways.
And in looking for that nostalgia, you'll notice that the actors, the characters in the film are looking for that old Germany back in the trash cans.
The little details, right?
Yes, exactly. The details to recreate. Things that have been stored away and forgotten about, we're going to resuscitate. And so it's an interesting concept of nostalgia.
Nostalgia, cultural memory, bringing it back. Yeah, that's a great point. The last film for the week is Midnight Traveler. And by the time this podcast is posted, it'll probably be too late. But we have a special guest coming to help us explicate the film a little bit, Emily Medavian, who's the producer and screenwriter for the film. She played a really important part beyond what a producer might typically play in the film, insofar that this is the story of Hassan Fazili and his family fleeing Afghanistan, and this is filmed in real time, that Hassan Fazili was sending the cards with the raw footage to Emily and her co-workers, and it was their job to stitch this together into a film, and this is an ongoing drama. They're fleeing Afghanistan. First they go to Tajikistan, then they have to go back to Afghanistan, then they go to Iran, then to Turkey, Bulgaria, Serbia, Hungary, all trying to make it to safety in Europe and Germany, particularly was their goal. And it was shot on three different cell phone cameras over the space of 2 years. And it's a challenging thing to film because, one, they're in the middle of things, and they don't know what's going to happen, right?
Absolutely.
And in fact, their fate is still a little bit up in the air.
Absolutely. As the mother Fatima says, wherever we can go, that's where we're going. And it made me reflect on my own life and how much I have the choice to go places and to be places. But for that family, it's very limited to where they will be accepted. So how do you tell your everyday life in crisis? And how do you find a narrative voice as you film your everyday life? I mean, those are questions that this film asks, and as well, what a great job they've done together as producers and writers.
It's a team effort, to be sure, yeah.
Yes, to tell this story, it's well done.
Well, and it continues this idea of walls, that you begin to understand what a serious thing a wall is between two countries. And it has really serious implications and consequences for, you know, for this particular family. This is, I saw this at Sundance and I was really, really taken by it. I was worried about the description saying, what, filmed on cell phones? That doesn't sound very good. It's, you know, these people knew what they were doing when it wasn't like me filming on my cell phone, right?
Absolutely, yeah. No. And we've seen, we've shown quite a few documentaries about immigration. A few years ago, Fire at Sea, and this semester, Human Flow. But this story is very personal. It's a personal documentary, an intimate look at the cost of immigration on a family level.
Yeah, that's right. Well, thank you for joining us today on From the Booth. Our podcast is produced by the International Cinema Program at BYU and supported by the BYU College of Humanities. The host and guests of this podcast are solely responsible for the opinions and ideas expressed here, as they do not represent any official position adopted by the university or its supporting institutions. As always, we thank our sound engineer, Joseph Hegstrom Pratt, as well as the staff of the BYU Humanities Resource Center and Humanities College web team for their help and support. Until next week, we hope to see you in 250 of the Kimball Tower. Thanks, Marina.
See you next week.